welcome to They Came From the North, your occasional dose of half-composed thoughts and analysis of famous filmmakers by four guys who voluntarily watched Heavy Traffic, for whatever that's worth. Today, we are going to be talking about John Ford. And with me, as usual, I'm Andrew Forbes, of course, your host. With me, as usual, are Steve Power.
Woo!
John Mercer.
Bam!
Stop masturbating. And Gabriel Gerard. Please don't say pow right in the kisser immediately after a masturbation comment.
Let's start over.
All right. No. We're in.
This is John Ford, damn it.
John Ford.
This is not the Michael Bay episode.
Which is why I have just been on a steady IV of rum since we started.
Are you sitting on the deck of your yacht?
Not yet. But I have,
is it like the alopecia or something?
A couple of B-list actors, so I'm feeling in the groove.
Hey.
Get into the groove.
Never mind. All right, so we're going to talk about the world's funkiest director, John Ford. Let's start with the long rambling intro. No other filmmaker is as significant in the construction of an American sort of entire cinematic mythology, both in terms of sort of starting American film and sort of telling the story of the actual country as John Ford. He's most commonly discussed in connection with the Western genre, but he was actually a tremendously versatile director. He made warm-hearted comedies, he made family dramas, he made war films, social critiques of every kind, and pretty much every sort of movie in between that you might be able to think of, with the possible exception of horror films or sci-fi. He was almost obsessive in his pursuit of sort of the cinematic American identity, especially with regard to the immigrant experience, the settlement of the Western territories, and the Irish-American experience. He was a diehard Irishman. He was the child of two Irish immigrants who had immigrated separately, met in the U.S. and married. John Ford was actually born John Feeney on February 1st, 1894-95. It varies depending on who's saying it. I think his headstone actually disagrees with public record, which is pretty appropriate for him because he was sort of known for embellishing the truth or altering it when the mood fitted him. He claims occasionally to have been born Sean O'Ferna. I believe at least once he claimed to have been born in Ireland as opposed to Maine. He was the 10th of 11 children of a shocker Catholic family. Only six of them lived until adulthood. So he had kind of a bit of a rough childhood. Not a lot of details on it, but I think maybe a bit of a turbulent family life. It was actually his brother Francis, 13 years his senior, who first went west to Hollywood. The elder brother adopted the stage name of Francis Ford, established himself as an actor in 1909, and then I think around 1912 as a director. He directed probably hundreds of short silence right at the beginning of the film industry. And in 1914, John followed his brother to California. He began appearing in Frank's films under the stage name of Jack Ford. He sort of had a few opportunities to do a few different jobs on these films. And when one director had a hangover and was offset sick, he managed to take the reins of a film. The producers were impressed, and he basically just continued to make movies. From that point on, showed a natural talent behind the camera and basically just got more and more opportunities to direct. He was, I think the diplomatic term would be notoriously tempestuous. The more accurate term, I think, would be he was a big asshole a lot of the time. it's a bit sad because, reading, his biography, and I strongly recommend the biography called Print the Legend. I can't remember the author's name at the moment, but it's a fantastic biography. He was plagued all his life by various insecurities. He dealt with it through alcohol. He had a very serious alcohol problem. So occasionally some of his tempestuousness was brought about through that. But he was also, I think, kind of he relished his position of power at times, psychological power and professional power. And he would often sort of single out a fresh face maybe one of the new sort of character actors on the side for abuse. But often even regulars and, you know, regulars like Ward Bond and even John Wayne were far from immune from his temper. And actually John Wayne spent probably most of his career sort of being on the bottom of the list, I think, as Jimmy Stewart put it, on John Ford's sort of when it came to taking his anger out on someone, often John Wayne would be the target. But on the other side, his sense of loyalty was extremely powerful, kind of difficult to define, though. He clearly felt a deep affection for many of his collaborators. He kept a regular company of actors, stuntmen, writers, and crew who showed up in over and over in his productions. He helped friends with financial difficulties. He would shepherd young families through troubled times. But, you know, if one of his friends breached his code of behavior, he might never speak to them again. One particularly notable instance is George O'Brien, who found himself shunned for years when he left Ford to an alcoholic depression in Southeast Asia. O'Brien had accompanied Ford on a tour of the region and was dismayed at being expected to wait around for an abusive, depressed old man to come to his senses because Ford had basically gone on a drinking binge, sort of hit rock bottom. He was out of his senses, a little bit like, you know, Martin Sheen at the beginning of Apocalypse Now. And, you know, O'Brien decided he was going to go and he wasn't just going to ruin this vacation after he'd sort of sat around for a few days. But Ford saw O'Brien's departure as an absolute betrayal, cut the actor from his company immediately upon his recovery, and it would be another 18 years before Ford would cast him again in a small role in Fort Apache. John Wayne suffered a similar experience right at the beginning of his career in 1930, the same year as the O'Brien incident, actually. Wayne had been discovered by Ford, but upon accepting the lead in Raoul Walsh's The Big Trail, was stonewalled by Ford until Stagecoach in 1939. So that was a long sort of dark period in Wayne's career. He wasn't really a star until Stagecoach, and he spent the intervening years doing a lot of really sort of low-rent pictures. Among Ford's interests were boating and naval warfare. He spent many years on a spacious yacht, the USS Ariner. The craft was a home at sea for Ford, and many scripts were developed during extensive cruises up and down the West Coast and into the Pacific. Ford took great pride in his naval experience during World War II, where he headed up a Navy film unit making propaganda and documentary films, including his legendary coverage of the Battle of Midway, which, you know, was just an accident. Ford was sort of on layover at Midway, obviously didn't know the Japanese were about to attack. And first thing in the morning, when the bombs started bursting, he ran out with a 16mm camera and got some fantastic footage. And the documentary got an Academy Award. I think that was 42, if my history serves me correctly. He was a big fan of the military, and he would often shame those of his friends who didn't take part in the war, including and especially John Wayne, who was abused mercilessly for what Ford saw as essentially draft dodging. Wayne had sort of repeatedly been in contact with Ford saying, oh, yeah, I'd love to join your film unit in the war. And he kept saying, you know, after the next picture, and ended up, you know, sitting out basically the entire war. A lot of people have sort of suspected that John Wayne's later super patriotism were sort of a result of a bit of shame, having sat out the war because he was a family man. He was in his mid-30s, so he was able to avoid the draft. But anyway, Ford, you know, was having none of this. He was basically shaming him, and especially on the set of 1945's They Were Expendable, and co-star and sort of war hero PT boat commander Robert Montgomery, who was the co-star, urged Ford to ease up on Wayne. I don't know what the effect was. I think maybe there was some effect, but anyway, Ford maintained his friendship with Wayne, who saw Ford as a bit of a mentor. And, you know, after the war, I would say most of their most notable films together came about. Ford's later career was plagued with problems, due in no small part to his alcoholism. During the 50s and 60s, Ford would often lose interest in a film during production or suffer severe alcoholic depressions, resulting in budgeting and schedule problems, often finding the director sort of temporarily replaced for part of the shoot, sometimes by the star. Films such as Mogambo and The Horse Soldiers in particular, I believe, saw Ford's focus sort of wane midway to the detriment of the production. I think for anyone who's seen them, they can attest to that.
Yes.
But, you know, aside from some rough spots, I don't think anyone can deny that he was a director of tremendous artistry. He projected an image of sort of a craftsman. He didn't like to talk about a lot of the details. You know, those films demonstrate a strong intelligence and subtlety, and obviously a spectacular painterly visual quality. Ford downplayed his creative process, pretending ignorance when asked about the underlying details of his films. Most famous in Peter, Did You Know I Know Orson Welles Bogdanovich's 1921 documentary directed by John Ford. It literally took him 3 minutes into that documentary to say Orson. Despite his protests, though, you know, it's impossible to ignore the depth of feeling and care behind Ford's work. He, you know, his films are full of an obvious love of folk culture, a sense of great familial warmth, you know, social justice, strict codes of honor and decency, and a really often complex and conflicting set of values in his films, especially the later ones, where he tends to explore the very complicated line between heroism and glory and the brutality of the American West. Anyway, so with that, that is John Ford in as much of a nutshell as I could put him in. So as usual, we are going to run through our good, our bad, and our ugly. And I think I am going to start with John Mercer. What is your good?
I'm a strong proponent of the belief that the truly great stories have villains that are just as memorable as the heroes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've actually got in my writing book, one of the inspirational quotes I got on the cover or on the inside cover, the immortal words of the gifted and wise Rowdy Roddy Piper. Do you think they would have loved you so much if they hadn't hated me? With that, my good would have to be, I believe it was 1962's The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance.
Nice.
You know, Liberty Valance has both. Great heroes, great villain. You know, John Wayne is John Wayne. He's not quite the larger-than-life persona the caricature we all remember. You know, he's more of a, what was his name in it? Dan...
Oh,
I can never remember his last name.
Donovan. Tom Donovan.
Yeah, Tom Donovan. Yeah. And, no, but he's, you know, rather he's a quieter man of the West. I think he's actually kind of supposed to embody the West itself, marching slowly towards the inevitable sunset of his time. Progress is coming. That progress is kind of personified in the movie by an earnest and likable Jimmy Stewart.
And the railroad, really, of course.
Yeah, and the railroad. And Jimmy Stewart is the railroad.
Jimmy Stewart is the railroad.
And it's...
Tom,
it's
Tom Donovan. Oh. Sorry, that was Catherine Hepburn.
Oh,
thank you for ruining this for me, guys.
I'm sorry.
You're welcome.
No, it's really fascinating to watch the two of them, but... You know, especially where Stewart's kind of the personification of the advancement that terrifies all the ranchers in the films. And then you have Lee Marvin.
I knew you wouldn't resist Lee Marvin.
I can't resist Lee Marvin as Liberty Valance.
You know, could?
He's a hurricane of testosterone and cruelty.
And spittle.
And spittle. Oh, he loves spitting on the camera and everyone's face.
What are you doing with that picture on your back?
You throw in a great supporting cast, and you got a Western that finds middle ground between epic and personal. And yes, Forbes, I do think it deserves a mention because of the bizarre paradox of John Wayne, a man we all know of more of a star than an actor, cold cocking both Stewart and Mervin with his collected eerie calm.
Yeah. Anyone who especially love think the... that John Wayne can act must watch this movie.
Yep.
I said you, Valance. You pick it up. And then when one of Valance's buddies reaches down to pick the steak, Wayne kicks him in the mouth.
I mean, the man but I mean, especially badass. In this movie, if you wanted to talk about Wayne's performance, you know, that sort of the moment where he goes back to his home under construction and, you know, gets drunk and basically completely breaks
it to the ground.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, the movie came out in 1962. The statute of limitations is long since passed.
Yeah, okay.
Well, see, you know, let's not try too hard to give stuff away.
There's a lot more in Liberty Valance to give away than that.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. Fair enough.
We're not even telling you who the man who shot Liberty Valance is.
No, which is good. Don't.
It's Lee Marvin.
Hey, stop that.
Yeah, it's a movie I think I like a lot. It's not sort of in my top three of John Ford, but I really, really like Wayne in it. And it's obviously done by someone who, in terms of like the, just the craft of filmmaking, is like at the absolute peak of his talents.
John Ford invented Monument Valley.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a place called John Ford Point in it now.
Oh, probably.
Probably shaped like a dick. Yeah, well, I'm going to – do you have anything else you want to say on that, John?
No, no, it's just it's a badass movie.
It really is a badass movie. It is.
And it's like it's one of my favorite types of Western where it is a little more personal, right?
It's it's really limited in terms of its scope.
Yeah, but, I mean, I'm a big fan of stuff like that. You know, I love Josie Wales. I love The Shootist, right? Mm-hmm. That's
The Shootist is so good.
Yeah, those are the Westerns I love, you know, and I mean, you want to go with more modern examples, The Assassination of Jesse James with the Coward Robert Ford, right?
Mm.
Just
also known as an American masterpiece.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, when they use the Westmore as a backdrop to get really into the characters, and, you know, it's like, don't go in expecting bang, bang, shoot 'em up action movie, because it's not that.
Mm-hmm.
You'll find that elsewhere in Ford's repertoire.
You definitely will, yes.
Well, just a really, really enjoyable movie.
And I think his last use of black and white after sort of a run of color as well.
Yep.
And it looks great.
It was one of his last movies, wasn't it?
Oh, it was pretty late. Yeah, he did.
I think
he did Cheyenne Autumn afterwards. He did
Seven Women,
Donovan's Reef afterwards. But it was. I think it's sort of generally agreed that Liberty Valance is kind of his last great movie.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I'm going to move on to Steve.
Yo,
what is your good?
We're going from east to west here now, are we?
I guess so. I don't know the specific geography in town.
Well, I think
I'm not in town.
I'm further east than John. Yeah. Okay. Never mind.
Oh, see, I'm shaking it off.
You're a little bit further east. I'm up north, further north than all of you.
Well,
all right, moving southeast.
I do have a real soft spot for the man who shot Liberty Valance because, well, hey, Lee Marvin. But I was really, really tempted to go with Stagecoach because it really wrote the blueprint. And for all the hype that Stagecoach gets, you know, like for all the talk of how effective the stunt work was and how, you know, it kind of created a lot of the beats that would become the modern action movie, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, all of that stuff is true. It's not an overrated thing. It's not, you know, some over-heralded masterpiece like certain other movies that I won't mention. It does live up to that reputation. It is a really good cracker of an action movie, you know? Like, it is...
And that, more, too.
And more, and then some. Yes, there's some great character beats. I love, like, the whole... The setting, how it's all just set on this stagecoach going from point A to point B, you know? And then how all the characters got there and stuff, you know? Like, it's a really, really, really good movie. But I have to go with what I consider to be Ford's masterpiece, and that is The Searchers.
Mm-hmm. Which is, I think a lot of younger people tend to dismiss The Searchers when they first watch it.
And
so we're going to show it love.
it's one of those movies, and I mean, I'm guilty as charged as well. You know, everybody's got this image of John Wayne that's just been perpetrated by pop culture, really. You know, it's like the whole image of Elvis Presley. You know, everybody pictures Elvis Presley just swaying and snapping his fingers and whatever else and forgets that, you know, at one point he was a damn good musician, you know?
Yeah.
But
people forget that John Wayne wasn't a caricature.
No, he really wasn't. And in The Searchers, more than anywhere else, like, he's really got that, I guess immersion is the word, you know, he's really into what he's doing. He got the credit for True Grit because, you know, hey, he's an old fart playing a tough guy and, you know, like kind of thing. And I think a lot of Wayne, like, yes, a lot of that caricature was earned, you know, like, I mean, we always had to joke ourselves, you know, when he was doing a Western, it was Pilgrim. And when he was doing a war movie, it was Soldier, you know. All right, Pilgrim. All right, Soldier. You know, like.
I think he only says Pilgrim.
He said that in Liberty Valance.
Yeah, Pilgrim is only in.
That's
it was a nickname he had for character. It was a nickname he had for character in another movie, which I think was a John Ford movie, actually. But, you know, the whole thing about The Searchers is Wayne has got an intensity in that movie. You know, and it's not just, you know, that Western tough guy intensity. He's got a real intensity of character in that movie. And you can see that there's a conflict in him. Like, you know,
I think he's got PTSD in that movie, actually.
Either way, you know, it's the whole thing is he's got a purpose in it.
Post-traumatic stress racism.
But it's very much, you know, like, he's very immersed in it, and Ford just shoots the hell out of it. You know, it is a beautiful movie to look at, especially on Blu-ray. The Blu-ray is absolutely stunning, and it moves really well. The action is really well done when the action comes into it. You know, but again, it's not a bang-bang shoot-em-up movie. It is more like Liberty Valance. It's more of a, you know, a character piece, and it is exceptionally well done. And then the plot, I think, is one of the most, I won't use the word mature, but, like, I guess darkly subjective of
well, you know, movies. I think when I talk to mostly younger people who've seen it and sort of dismiss it, they look at sort of the surface racism of it, and they assume that that's kind of like the thesis of the movie, that, you know, that it's just, oh, Indian's bad, and he's going to go and find this person. And it's really one of John Ford's most complex looks at the various kind of dynamics in this period of settlement and conflict and taking land and, you know, new opportunities and changing times, and all of this stuff is just mixed up in a really intelligent way.
Yes, and I mean, sorry, Gabe.
I was going to say, although I didn't, sadly didn't have time to watch The Searchers, from what I've seen of Ford's work, you can never call him reductive. You know, there's always a big, large canvas with a variety of characters. You know, there's not a single point of view.
And it's never really as simple as clear-cut black and white, you know. And someone, I can understand, like, a young, you know, late teens or early 20-something youth sitting down, just getting into movies, digging into some of these classic films and going, wow, racist, you know, but it's not essential. Like, it really isn't that, you know. It's easy to point at it and say, oh, look, racism, but it really isn't that. It is more of just, you know, no, the fact that this went on at this point in time in history doesn't make it proper or correct, but this is how people thought. You know, this was, you know, it's not right.
Kind of an analog to the John Wayne character in it.
Yeah.
It's not a perfect analog because the characters are totally different. But I'm going to unfortunately evoke Joss Whedon here, and Dan Mancini is going to kill me. But, you know,
you just evoke Joss Whedon in two Searchers.
Yeah, I know.
Which is one of Dan's sacred cows.
I know. But, I mean, I always think of this because in Serenity, there's a character, the villain, who, you know, talks about essentially being a necessary monster.
Yes.
Who doesn't belong in the world he's building.
Exactly.
Right? And although, you know, John Wayne's character isn't the kind of you know, clear-eyed, you know, sees his own role in this. That's kind of what he is.
Yeah.
You know, he can't progress into what he's trying to build. And he's really ugly in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
But he's necessary.
Exactly. And I mean, like, it's a simple, you know, the other thing too, I don't want to spoil it. So I don't want to get into why he's doing what he's doing, like who it is they're searching for and why, but you know, like that twist, that realization, you know, that his quest is not a noble quest, you know, it's just kind of like, oh snap. Like the first time I really saw it in that context, it was just like, wow, you know, that's right. Like this is, he's not trying to save somebody here, you know?
And you know, one of the most, I think probably kind of impactful things about it is, you know, the complicated look at how people are in the way that he's so determined to go through with this for years and years and years and years. And then it's sort of like it literally is just like a look that completely changes his entire, you know, his entire goal, I guess.
Yeah.
At a crucial moment.
Exactly.
But it's really, really good. And it looks amazing.
It does. And I think it also proves that with Wayne, you know, like, instead of being this pop culture caricature or whatever, and I think there's other actors nowadays who will be remembered the same way, like by people like us who've seen the movies. You got guys like Mel Gibson or Russell Crowe who have this tough guy reputation, who have this reputation of just being, you know, hard men in hard movies kind of thing. But you will realize, like people will realize that these guys are talented actors. They just do what they do extremely well, you know? And I think like a lot of that comes from Wayne's performances as well, you know, like, not to say that they're sitting there studying John Wayne on a daily basis, but you can tell that there's definitely a little of that persona in there, you know?
And man, when he comes back from seeing what's been done to one of the characters.
Yeah.
And he basically says, you know, don't ever ask me to describe what I saw.
Yeah.
That's just like that. That shows you that he can be an extremely good actor.
Yeah. He's not just this slow talking drawly cowboy stereotype that rolled in off the high plains, you know? Mm-hmm. He's not the steely eyed Clint Eastwood. If anything, Eastwood's more of a character than Wayne is.
Yeah. Although I love them both.
Oh, like, well, I mean, I'm more of an Eastwood fan to be honest, but you know, credit where credit is due. Wayne is definitely more versatile.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think I'm going to move on. Gabe, what's your good?
Just to be different, I went with something that's not a Western and does not star John Wayne.
And this is not allowed.
You heathen.
You snooty Quebecois.
And I chose The Grapes of Wrath.
I cannot argue with that.
I can't stay mad at you, Gabe. You're like which a host.
You had me at grapes.
Which is, I mean, it's a really affecting movie, with a really wide canvas that feels like, I'll get into that later. But another movie that I saw from John Ford, like, didn't adapt the novel so well, and this one feels like, you know, it feels organic. You have these kind of side stories, and it all comes to do her whole. And what really impressed me was Henry Fonda's character, because you're really used to the Henry Fonda, again, the Henry Fonda persona of the, you know, he's usually the right man, the man who stands for justice, the kind of clean guy, you know, he's 12 Angry Men.
Young Mr. Lincoln?
He's young Mr. Lincoln.
Yeah.
He's their juror in 12 Angry Men, you know?
What's kind of funny is the first thing that ever comes into my head when I picture Henry Fonda is Once Upon a Time in the West.
Yeah.
For our generation,
that's Henry Fonda.
That's why Leone chose him for that role too, to kind of screw with people.
Yeah.
But anyways, his performance in this movie, his character is more kind of shady, and he's got a lot of anger. And I was kind of trying to figure out the title of, you know, where does these Grapes of Wrath fill in? And I think it can stand for both the character Rath because it gets him into trouble constantly. I mean,
and a freakish testicular disorder.
Yeah, and but also it speaks to the Rath that the people get by being oppressed and wanting to rise up against the big capital, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what what's interesting about the movie, that at the same time, it's a really engaging family story with a lot of strong performances. I really liked the woman who played the mother.
Cast is unreal.
Yeah.
Majo.
And there's both that side to it, and then there's the social idea, which is also well seen, and even like the kind of community that they go into the end, you see that nothing's really perfect in there. Mm-hmm. And I like one thing that kind of struck me was the look that the guy at the community gave Henry Fonda. You know, he like at the end of the interview, he has like this look that he knows that this is the guy that killed
mm-hmm.
before.
It's, you know, I think if there's a failing to the movie, for me, it's that sometimes it's a little too sort of on the nose about the fact that it's a social statement.
Mm-hmm.
But I think a lot of that can probably be traced back to the Steinbeck novel.
Yeah.
But, you know, despite that, it's still a really complex and, I mean, gorgeously shot movie. There's stuff in...
Greg Toland, right, I think?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's stuff in this. I mean, there's one scene, I think it's with John Quaylen as Muley, sort of in this old dark house, and it's like these sort of wide angle shots really close on faces, and it's really like stark, dramatic stuff. And a lot of the lighting experiments and stuff in this and in The Long Voyage Home, which were both in 1940, you basically would not have Citizen Kane looking like Citizen Kane.
Yeah.
If he hadn't been doing the sort of experimenting that he was doing with John Ford in those two movies. And I mean, there's the whole, you know, the shots going into the kind of like shanty town,
mm-hmm.
On the bumper of the truck. It's just like great, great stuff.
And yeah, you know, like some really like chilling stuff, like when they leave the house and they look back, you know, that's really affecting at the beginning when they're forced to go away. And you see, like, the desolate house standing all alone, this feeling of emptiness that they get.
Yeah.
I find,
you know, sometimes when John Ford tries to mix that kind of feeling with humor, it can feel false. But in this one, he finds a really good balance. Like, there's, you know, there's that, and then there's, like, the moment with the truck almost tipping over, and you just hear, like, whoa, and then they go on the road, and so you get that kind of mix of tones, but it works really well in this one.
I mean, there's so much great stuff. We haven't even talked about the guy who plays the preacher.
Mm-hmm.
It was really good too, and one of the, I won't say what happens to him, but it's pretty shocking. But yeah, I mean, there's nothing I can think of, like you said, Andrew, that could take away from that movie. It's pretty much perfect in what it's trying to do.
Yeah. And I mean, like you said, Henry Fonda, he sort of runs hot and cold for me. But in this one, he's the perfect choice, I think, for the role.
And I mean, you look at him and, you know, with the little cap on, and you get him right away. This guy thinks he's so cool, right?
Yeah. All right. Well, I think I'm going to talk just for a couple of minutes about my choice for good. And I kind of cheated because I couldn't decide which of the late 40s through 1950 cavalry trilogy I wanted to talk about. So I'm going to talk about all of them sort of as a group.
I see how it is.
So Fort Apache, She Wore a Yellow Ribbon, and Rio Grande, in that order. John Ford had, I guess, like a contract with Marion C. Cooper or something where he kind of, and it may have sort of led up to The Quiet Man, but he sort of agreed he was going to do these three cavalry pictures.
One of them, I know one of them for sure was definitely kind of a precursor to The Quiet Man.
Mm-hmm. And Taken, I mean, they're often talked about together, which is another reason I thought I'd cheat, because they really do feel like they're kind of a collective exploration of how the cavalry worked and how that sort of the tension between the Aboriginal people and the cavalry who were essentially there to kick them off their land. And what he does with the movies is he does a great job of kind of picking apart the nobility of what the cavalry people were doing, which typically is less about nation building. It's more about their codes of honor, the loyalty they have to each other, and sort of the good acts they're able to it's not always violence against the Indians. There's especially in John Wayne's character, sometimes he's able to sort of act as a bit of a mediator. But, you know, so there's a noble side, but then there's also the ugly side of nation building, and in particular the U.S., which is these, you know, massacres and conflicts between starving people and kind of lonely guys at these distant outposts. You know, all three are shot in Monument Valley, which is sort of like Ford's go-to place. And he really, he kind of, when in Once Upon a Time in the West, when Sergio Leone shot there, it was almost kind of shocking to see it in another filmmaker's movie. You know, like it's so John Ford. John Wayne is in all three of the movies, playing the lead. I think in two of them, you're going to hear my mouse clicking a bit here, he plays Kirby York, but spelled differently and at obviously different points in their career. So they're based on, I think, some short stories by the same author. And Ford kind of picked these stories up and played with them a bit and drew out some more interesting ideas than what was sort of shown in the source. Fort Apache is this great movie about, we get Henry Fonda again, playing this kind of, he's a little bit of like a Custer type figure, who's very concerned about how he operates in the military, and it's all about military image in the United States, and he's, you know, ready to go out and massacre people. And at the end, you know, there's a lot dealing with how history remembers people who aren't necessarily heroic, but, you know, they need a hero. So they sort of, choose the more colorful people and clean up their story a bit while other people are forgotten. She Wore a Yellow Ribbon is another example of John Wayne being a really good actor. He's playing someone who's sort of, in his 60s, even though this was 49, so he was still quite young. But he's completely convincingly playing an older man at the end of his career. It's the only of the three movies shot in color, and it's like crazy color, like amazing looking movie. You get some fantastic quiet scenes of him at his family's gravestones talking to them, of him sort of considering the end of his career and what he's accomplished, talking to his men. There's a great touching scene of him receiving a gift from his men and sort of having to dig out his glasses and self-consciously put them on as he reads an inscription on a gift. And it's also a movie about, older men having seen enough of war and trying to use their experience to avoid conflicts. Rio Grande, I think, is probably, I would say it's the weakest of the three, but it's still a really good movie. And it's, again, John Wayne is playing Kirby York. And in this case, it has, there's an element, again, of the cavalry dealing with tensions between, the official U.S. expansionist position and, natives not wanting to leave their land. But then there's also a smaller family drama that takes place, where John Wayne's son comes in as a raw recruit, just almost by chance under his command, and him seeing his son growing up and considering his career as a whole and where's his son going to go going to end up. And Maureen O'Hara is in this one, playing his estranged wife. And again, I mean, it's a very thoughtful look at this particularly interesting period in American history, and absolutely not a sort of reductive look at it. It's a very considered approach to the subject in all three movies. So I would recommend all of them. They are great. So that's my good. I cheated. Hopefully I wasn't too rambly.
Not at all.
So let us move on to our bad. Again, for anyone who doesn't know, our bad is not, strictly speaking, bad movies. They're movies that have mixtures of positive and negative elements and may fall somewhere just short of good, anywhere to just shy of ugly. So I am going to start again with John. What's your bad?
Just bear with me one second here. My notes seem to have frozen up. I won't sound intelligent. No, I'm just kidding. My bad. I believe it was 1937. The Hurricane.
Hmm.
Those are two of the whitest Samoans I have ever seen. Ladies and gentlemen, I present to you the Titanic of the 1930s.
Yeah.
A light and fluffy romance punctuated by an extended special effect.
And it was pushed to that too as a production, I think.
Yeah.
I don't remember the special effect. What was the special effect?
Basically a 15-minute long hurricane in 1930.
That's right, yeah.
I thought it was like people with Samoans. Sorry.
Yeah, and convincingly portraying white people as Samoans. Well, actually not really convincingly.
I think I've seen it, but I don't really remember.
Thanks, Malenga. You're the best, doll. Yeah, no, it's not really a whole lot I can say about the hurricane. Just, you know, years before Michael Bay made Pearl Harbor, Don Ford made the hurricane.
I haven't seen Does it feel like it's sort of a director for hire job, or?
Yeah, kind of. And it's less of a John Ford movie and more of another hit from Samuel Goldwyn.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And it's just, you know, there's nothing real special about the story. You know, it's about a Samoan sailor or a Fijian sailor, wherever he's supposed to be from. An islander who gets married. His wife has a bad premonition, something bad's going to happen. She begs him to either stay or take her with him. And, of course, like, no, baby. And he goes off and gets in a bar fight with a needlessly racist Frenchman.
Is there any other sort?
Aren't all
you
Frenchmen
look up when the white man talks to you. And he ends up breaking the guy's jaw in a bar fight and getting sent to prison and tries to escape multiple times. Ends up, you know, gets a sentence of 16 years. And when he finally escapes and attempts to canoe back to his wife, a hurricane lands on top of him.
I saw this movie.
It's not a bad movie. It's just, Andrew was just talking about the greatness of the Cavalry trilogy. You know, we were talking about, you know, Ford's made some pretty damn good movies.
I love the part in it where his mysterious cellmate. I love the part in it where his mysterious cellmate teaches him how to sword fight and tells him where he buried his treasure.
Don't you ever, ever talk smack about Count Monte Cristo in my presence. Ever. Okay, I've got the full-length book at home. It weighs about 15 pounds. I will beat you to death with it.
Yeah.
Not if I beat you to death first with my archival edition of Lord of the Rings.
Do my
last
Tolkien.
Can we assemble some more tangents to eventually come back?
No, it's The Hurricane is just a fairly light and fluffy popcorn movie.
Can I assume by the fact that Dudley wrote the screenplay that it was really flowery and overwritten?
Oh, was it ever.
You can assume by the fact that it was made in the 1930s that it was flowery and overwritten.
Again, thank you, Olenka. You're yourself.
Awesome. All right. Well, again, moving southeast, Steve. What is your bad?
Oh, speaking of the Titanic of, I don't even remember what year this came out, but I've got to go with Mogambo.
Oh, like 64 or something, I think.
You're the best, doll.
Yeah, it has to be Mogambo.
Mogambo is the best day.
I just, no.
This is one of those ones where he basically, like, he did it because he needed to work, and it was not a personal movie.
Well, you know, it's a situation. I watched it when I first watched it. I had one of these. First time I saw it, I had one of these packages, you know, one of these DVD verdict care packages that showed up for review, and it was this TCM Turner Classic Movies romance pack or something, right? That Mogambo happened to be one of the movies in it, and I was like, okay, that sounds pretty good, just reading the description on the back. Then I fired it up and I saw the credits and I saw Clark Gable. I was like, oh no. No, there
hold
are...
on. Before we go off against Clark Gable, It Happened One Night is an amazing comedy.
Listen,
continue.
Listen. My hatred, my fiery hatred for Clark Gable burns like the heat of a thousand suns, okay?
Like the fiery cracks of Mount Doom?
Like the passion of a thousand matadors.
I am not a fan of Clark Gable. Really not a fan. And that movie did nothing.
Have you seen It Happen One Night?
Is Clark Gable in it? Then fuck no.
No.
The only way I would watch It Happen One Night is if... No, I can't. No, there's no way I would watch it because Clark Gable's in it. I just know. I can't. If I see his name, I walk away. I wash my hands of this.
Mogambo.
Mogambo. It's not a good movie. It's a bad movie. It's, well, no, actually, you know what? Some of it was okay whenever Clark Gable wasn't involved, which was very rarely.
It's a fair movie.
Yeah, but he's just...
Oh, that wasn't Mogambo. You're thinking about Gunga Din again.
No, I'm not thinking. I like Gunga Din.
You're a better man than I, Gunga Din.
No, it's just, you know, that whole... The tristy romance with the lion, the guy on the African safari and yada yada. Oh, it was just light, fluffy, disposable. And then there was Clark Gable.
I mean, given that you have Ava Gardner
on
and
scale,
Grace Kelly, it's pretty dull.
On a scale of 1 to 10, how Gable-esque was his mustache?
It was pretty Gable-esque.
Did you say gay burlesque?
That's exactly what I said.
Is that the box set
that came with Gunga Din?
I don't think it is. I think Gunga Din came
in. The TCM classic one, I mean, I think it was in a romance one and like an adventure one, maybe.
I think it was the one that had like... I can't even remember what else was in there. There was an early Marlon Brando movie that sucked really bad. And there was some movie, I think it might have been Catherine Hepburn in a mental institution in the 1930s. And, you know, it was bad.
It's like a Catherine Hepburn documentary.
It's just, generally speaking, you know, Mogambo was not a pleasant experience for me because I was trying to plow through 40s melodramatic movies. That's it, I think.
And it is also, I mean, on the Clark Gable note, it is also like latter-day Clark Gable where he's older and wrinkly, and it's kind of like your greasy hair isn't appealing.
Yeah, his good looks had faded and his youth had faded, and all that was left was bitter, bitter tears.
And a mustache.
And his mustache, of course. He always had that goddamn mustache.
Cool.
That penciled in... shit-eating mustache.
Well, at least you can rest easy that the Rocketeer fucked his shit up, so.
All right. Is that all on Mogambo? Mogambo. You want to say it really loud? Mogambo.
Mogambo. I did really like Ava Gardner.
Well, that's not difficult.
Yeah. So yeah, there we go.
Okay. Yep. Well, let your tolerance for Clark Gable determine whether or not you view it. All right, Gabe. You're up. What's your bad?
For mine, I chose a movie that's like a shaving close to be a good, but didn't quite get there for me, and that is Al Green with My Valley. It does feel.
I repeat, you heartless bastard.
It does feel like a very personal movie for Ford. It is beautifully directed. There are lots of interesting moments in it, but this is the movie I was referring to earlier, where it does feel very adapted from a novel, and that some of the little parts you would want to get more of those because there's not enough, and it seems to go a bit on tangents here and there and doesn't tell a really cohesive story. Also, I found it pretty kind of sappy at some point and pretty melodramatic, a bit too much. I'm thinking especially of that scene where the mother and the young kid are kind of drowning in the ice. And when I watched that scene, I was like, I was both feeling sorry for them, but also almost on the verge of laughing because it was so over the top.
If you've ever been down in the mines, you wouldn't feel this way.
And, I mean, Ford does push the pathos a little bit too much at certain points. And for me, the scenes that were most effective were the ones that he didn't try so much or that he tried a little bit of comic stuff. Like, I'm thinking of the guys showing up in school and beating up the teacher. That scene I really liked, or some of the dialogue between the pastor and Angarad, or however you pronounce her stupid name.
It's Welsh. You don't pronounce it. You write it. You don't even write it. You just say it's a Welsh name, and you leave it at that.
But, yeah, once again, I mean, this is not a bad movie in any sense. It just, with a few adjustments, it could be a really great movie, I think. But for me,
it is it's a very sentimental movie.
Yes.
I watched it, and it is. I mean, there are parts that certainly reach into melodrama. I found it. Maybe it was the fact that I watched it after a long run of John Ford movies, so I was becoming slightly inoculated against his sentiment. I watched it and I found it to be a very sort of warm-hearted and sort of bittersweet look at
mm-hmm.
a working-class way of life and how we tend to romanticize the past even when there are very dark things going on in it. And Walter Pidgeon is really good in it.
Oh, yeah.
He's an actor who sometimes can be a bit too stiff, I find, but it kind of works in his favor here.
Mm-hmm.
And there's that great scene where he starts to sing, and he's got that big booming voice, and I think nobody's really sort of expecting it, and they're in that small house all singing together. That's really good.
Well, again, it's one of those kind of little moments, that are kind of...
It's a movie sort of made up of little moments.
Yeah, exactly.
Like I say, it doesn't really have a structure. It's kind of a... Not so much slice of life. It's like many slices of life.
Mm-hmm.
And I think... I mentioned briefly in my intro that John Ford, as a child, and also I think during his adult life, his family life was not great, and he tends to portray families very... Not necessarily idyllically, but... as a really strong units that are sort of the backbone of a lot of communities.
Mm-hmm.
And you definitely get the sense of that in How Green Was My Valley.
Yeah, and that push does give the movie a little bit of its downward thing for me, where You know, at one point, the whole village hates the family because the dad spoke against the union. But then the wife almost drowns, and then everybody loves them again, you know?
I like it.
No, I mean, for this podcast, it is my bad because I liked it, but it doesn't quite reach, you know, the really good ones.
It's definitely worth watching, you know, for Roddy McDowell when he was really young and before he became an ape. like, he gives one of the best child performances I've seen.
Oh, definitely.
Movie. He obviously sort of had the instincts of a much older actor because he doesn't overplay things. He doesn't, I mean, if any of the actors are sort of overly sentimental, it's the adults.
Mm-hmm.
And he's quite sort of natural in the role of Hugh. Solid. All right. It's me now, I think.
Yeah.
So my bad is, I just did briefly when we were talking about Grapes of Wrath, The Long Voyage Home, which is, was also made in 1940. It was based on a collection of short stories by Eugene O'Neill about sailors. And it there's really kind of expressionist sort of photographed movie about a group of sailors who are, you know, they're living the hard life of sailors and, you know, trying to find romance when they're not really allowed to have one on board. And, you know, one guy can hide at one point and the others have to rescue him. All of these various conflicts that come up, and it looks gorgeous. It has John Wayne playing Swede, if anything, he seems even younger than a stagecoach in this. He's kind of like the kid brother of the rest of the crew, and he's playing this really sort of quiet, sort of shy guy who's like the exact opposite of the John Wayne persona that people tend to think of, he's got a Swedish accent, which just seems strange because of John Wayne. There's a lot going for the movie. Again, you know, it had a lot of the cinematography techniques that would show up in Citizen Kane. Greg Toland was the director of photography. But it feels, you know, you can tell it's based on more than one short story. It feels really sort of choppy and like there's not a... It doesn't really feel like there's a strong thread leading through from the beginning to the end. It's very heartfelt, and there are a lot of great moments in it, but it doesn't come together. You know, when I think back to it, I think of fragments, and I find it hard to sort of remember the flow of the story because it feels like, you know, something happened, and then something happened, and then something else happened, and there's not a consistent drive sort of pushing the movie forward. At the same time, you know, watching it, it doesn't get boring. It doesn't, you know, when you're watching it, you're not feeling like I didn't feel like it was dragging. I didn't feel like it was necessarily like a broken movie. It's just, afterwards, there's a bit of a sense of it not cohering. But it's really nice. I recommend it. And it's got Thomas Mitchell, who is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
I actually really enjoy it myself.
Yeah. I'm trying to think. There was who's the actor who's in? Oh, John Quaylen. Yeah, he's another sort of one of the Ford Stock Company who's also in this one. Barry Fitzgerald's in it. Warren Bond is in it. So you know, a lot of the faces you see in his other movies show up here, and it kind of feels like you're just sort of hanging out with some likable guys who get in some fights and but obviously have a you know a strong affection for each other. So. It's a good movie, but it's a bad movie apparently. In the podcast, Thomas reminded me of Stagecoach because he's amazing in that, and then that reminded me of a side character that we didn't talk about when we were talking about Liberty Valance, and I want to do a quick detour because we didn't talk about what's his face plays writer in Liberty Valance and is the most hilarious character ever, who's quoting Shakespeare and getting drunk. And who played him? Somebody tell me.
Just saying,
he's awesome.
Getting up that Wikipedia.
What?
That would be...
Edmund
O'Brien.
Edmund O'Brien, Dutton Peabody. No courage left. He's so good in that movie. Anyway.
He's drunk in the Wikipedia picture. Look at those eyebrows.
You sure it's not Oliver Reed?
Oliver Reed just predicts rage. All right, so that was our bad. So we're going to move on to the slightly less pleasant arena of the ugly. And these are movies that we have no qualms about saying that they are really, really not successful. They are painful to watch, probably. So I'm going to go in reverse order, and I'm going to go with Gabe. What is your ugly?
For mine, I chose a lesser-known film by Ford called The Informer. It's a movie set in Ireland about a guy who decides to inform on a co-IRA plotter or whatever to get the reward. And this is John Ford going to do German expressionism. it is. But
it's a really studio feeling picture.
Yeah,
like you can tell it's all soundstage. And
yeah, and I mean, it kind of works in a way, but the story is really slow. And the main fact that I have against it is the main character.
Victor McLaughlin.
Yeah, even the character himself, like even with another actor, he's not interesting and he's kind of hateful. But yeah, the main actor is all kinds of terrible. I mean, it's like, basically, it's like John Ford was like directing him to be in a silent film. And anytime he doesn't speak, it's perfect. He had like this great look on his face. And he's very still, and he conveys a lot of emotion with his still face. But each time he starts to act, oh, man.
Victor McLaughlin is like, I'm in this and also in The Loss Patrol. Like, the lead actor, he's terrible. He's in the cavalry movies in, like, side roles and sort of comic relief, and he's better there because he's supposed to be sort of a stupid oaf. But man, whenever you make the lead character, it's just painful, especially dramatic.
And like the place where I completely kind of lost interest was where, like, the movie, although the story wasn't really pulling me in, I was kind of into it because of the style that Ford gave it, which was really like he saw a quick long film and he was copying it, you know. But then there's a scene, like, I don't know, somewhere like 50 minutes in or something, where he goes to see the chief of the IRA, and then the chief of the IRA tells him to find the stoolie. And I'm like, okay, that's way too much, like, guilt. And, you know, I mean, I was like, man, even Paul Schrader wouldn't go this far into guilt.
What irony.
It's
a very heavy-handed story.
And the movie kind of stops there because it's a very dialogue-heavy scene, and the camera stays into one spot, and there's just like this, you know, the one shot, just talking dialogue, and you're like, oh man, when will this be over? So yeah.
Well, you know, it's probably fair to say that John Ford did that scene too. He would like tear pages out of scripts and just like. No, we're not doing that.
what was the big story? The whole, we're behind, John, we're behind, you know, we'll never catch up. And he just rips a page out, throws it, he says, there, now we're caught up.
Well, the great thing, too, in directed by John Ford, where Jimmy Stewart talks about, you know, them sitting around doing a script reading, and, you know, John Ford, he wouldn't like a piece of dialogue, and someone would, and he'd just be like, oh, what script do you have? No, that's not the right script. Just take that out. Instead of saying, like, you know, he'd sort of just, kind of the time, it was a terrible line, but he'd just sort of say, oh, no, you must have a different script. My script is great.
But it's a really bad right.
Yeah, it's not great. I think, you know, in terms of, like, a critical study of John Ford, it's pretty important, but it's hard to watch.
Mm-hmm.
When I tried to watch it, I didn't get very far. Yeah. All right. Moving east and some direction, probably north. Northeast, Steve.
Oh, God. I... No. Okay, this
there
next one...
God,
It is a John Ford movie. And it does star both Lee Marvin and John Wayne.
Oh, dear. I know where this is going.
Donovan's Reef is a big, fat pile of shit. There's no easy way to say it. It's a terrible, horrible, light, fluffy, completely ignorant...
Mom, Steve said a bad word.
It's a piece of shit.
John Ford just cruised on his yacht, didn't even bother getting out of the deck chair. And
no,
went,
yeah,
hey, like, you two fight.
Yeah. Yeah, racism's bad, okay? Oh, but wait, she's my sister. Hug, kiss, roll credits. You know, like, oh my God, just such a terrible, ham-handed, brutal, like incredibly difficult to watch, glacially paced, just. Awful, awful, awful movie. I can't go any further.
It's supposed to be like a brawling kind of like buddy comedy sort of thing.
Not even remotely.
Like, shouldn't you like make that like taste like chop, chop, chop?
Yeah, and it's not. I mean, you know, like,
that was the appeal apparently.
It's this horrible, heavy-handed. You know, racism is bad, and okay? You know, like it's oh man. It's just such a bad movie.
Yeah. Well, I won't force you to live through any further details.
I can't. And John Wayne would like the characters, guns and boats.
Guns and boats. Like
John Wayne plays guns. Lee Marvin plays boats.
John Wayne.
Even the trailer is hard to sit through.
It's a horrible, horrible movie.
According to Wikipedia, it's a morality play in the guise of an action comedy.
Yeah.
Wikipedia is wrong. You sure you're not looking at Wikipedia there, John?
Encyclopedia.
All right, John, with your ugly. Have you had
another
drink?
Yeah, sorry. Just give me 1 second. Let's pause for a moment. But the door was just knocked.
Oh, no.
Now.
Yeah.
Okay, my ugly. Just give me a second. Let me finish this beer.
Come on.
One thing I hate from a director, especially one with Ford's pedigree, it's a sandbag. And that's what Born Reckless is. Just the entire movie just goes up in the air and then goes limp. Which is really sad because it's a really cool concept for a story. You know, a gangster gets busted and make the choice between going to war or going to jail. And then when he survives the former... He comes home a changed man, faces his former life. You were to take that, rework it to take place during Nam, my ticket's already paid for. Sadly, Ford's presence is barely felt on this one. It's one of his few co-op efforts, which means they didn't have a second director because he was too drunk to finish it. You know, it's got flashes of the Ford look, little else outside of a stunning collection of wooden performances, really, really stilted 1930s dialogue, and just a surplus of wasted potential.
Man, everyone loves Edmund Lowe.
No, nobody does.
I don't even know who that is.
His career took a George Raft. So it's not Scarface, is what you're saying.
No. No, it's definitely not.
Oh, and look at that. It's written by Dudley Nichols.
That's bad.
The Dudley Nichols fan. Awesome. Any additional details you want to run through?
No.
Okay.
No, not at all.
Well, I am going to talk about My Ugly then, and that is Mary Scotland. This movie was basically made because John Ford had a crush on Katharine Hepburn. And they reminisced sort of later in their career. I think when they first met about it, she said, you know, I can't think of anyone worse to play Mary of Scotland. He said, well, that's fine because I don't think anybody could be worse a choice for director. And like, there's no reason John Ford should never be like a Elizabethan ruffs and pantaloons picture. It is so far out of his wheelhouse. This movie just doesn't work at all. It, aside from some really good production design, it is just one bad decision after another. It's like a terrible attempt at sort of political scheming type thriller, with the most sneering, obviously, like if Elizabeth I had a mustache, she would be twirling it. It is, you've got John Carradine playing Mary's Italian secretary with a terrible accent. You've got Frederick March playing sort of like butch Scottish Earl who is, you know, Mary of Scotland likes him because he's frank and he doesn't treat her like a queen while he's doing a horrible Scottish accent and she's sort of mooning around the castle, mopey. You've got people scheming against her. Suddenly all the people come out and they join together in an obvious, you know, like fawning praise communal song. With apparently they spontaneously came up with lyrics that were all about how great Mary of Scotland is. And you get a really sappy solo by Gabe. I don't know if you remember the Irish singer sort of leaning on a lamppost in The Informer.
Yeah, I do.
Singing that horrible, you know, he's got that awful sort of folksy style of singing. He shows up sort of leading the choir of Scots people. You have a whole array of accents. You can't tell. Ford does a horrible job of keeping track of who is on what side, scheming with who against who. It's almost impossible to tell what the conflict is supposed to be. The final big conflict is handled awfully. Hey, guess who did the screenplay? Dudley Nichols.
Yeah.
The worst kind of, you know, flowery, like fake kind of old Englishy type, just terrible. And I don't know. Katharine Hepburn is sort of like, she's supposed to be the anchor of this story. And I think you're supposed to need someone who's kind of like an otherworldly beauty to sort of just captivate people when she's just hovering on the screen. And I think it did it for John Ford, because obviously they got into a relationship at one point, which complicated his marriage a bit, but it's kind of like, I'm sorry, Steve, I don't mean to, you know, take a blow against Temple of Doom because I actually like that movie, but I think it's the same way that Steven Spielberg saw Kate Capshaw and just couldn't see any of the faults. That he was just like, oh, I'm in love with you. That happens here. It's a director who is so focused on being infatuated with the lead actress that he forgets he's supposed to be directing the movie, on top of being the worst choice as director for this movie. If you put, there are tons of directors at the time who, you know, this would have been just their bread and butter. Like, if you'd gotten Michael Curtiz to do this, it would have been brilliant. You just get, you know, he's a solid studio hand, he has a great look, He does this stuff all the time, Oscar and Brahma. He kind of knocks it out of the park. You put a guy like John Ford, who has a strong personal vision that is in a totally different world from this, and has no interest in movies about, you know, scheming politicians 400 years ago, you get a disaster. And that's what it is. So I would avoid it at all costs. Unless you want to see Joe Carradine doing a bad Italian accent. And who doesn't? Me.
You. Or me.
Yeah. Yeah. But you got it.
I don't know.
Yeah. All right. So then there's any final thoughts on John Ford before we wrap up?
I got a few.
Steve?
Going back and like rewatching a lot of Ford stuff, I mean, I always considered, you know, he wrote the book really on visual filmmaking, and I mean, some of the credit even that goes to other directors like Hitchcock and Wells and like some of these other really like strong early visualists. I think Ford kind of laid the blueprint. He laid the foundations.
Mm-hmm.
I think really like Ford is a name, like everybody seems to know the name, but nobody really seems to know the pictures, or they chalk mm-hmm. him up to being just, you know, a Western director. But I don't think people really realize just how responsible this guy was for what we now consider movies. Like you know,
the visual grammar of movies.
The language. I mean, the language of the art form. You know, it like he really was. I mean, like there's a lot of other guys out there who I like more. You know, I like Wilder, Curtiz. Kurosawa, of course. But I mean, every one of these guys was influenced by him. You know, like.
Kurosawa for sure.
Oh, big time. Hugely so. But I mean, you know, it's like Ford, I mean, the language of action cinema in particular, this guy really laid a lot of the groundwork. And, you know, yes, other guys have perfected and innovated since then, but, you know, everybody really making movies today owes some manner of debt to John Ford's work, you know, like whether directly or indirectly, they do, even if they don't realize.
And unlike something like Birth of a Nation, where obviously it innovated a lot, but when you go back, it's really painful to watch.
Yeah, no, his stuff is genuinely, you know.
It's still entertaining. It's still complex in a way that a lot of contemporary forms.
I can still sit down and I can pop on Stagecoach and enjoy it without any of this, you know, without any of this stuffy era of film schoolery. You know, I can sit down and Stagecoach is a genuinely good movie, just like Seven Samurai or Casablanca or, you know, like.
You don't have to watch it as. It's not a good movie for a 1939 movie.
Yes, exactly. It's just an all-around good movie. He's got a body of work full of that stuff. And the other thing I love about John Ford is the man himself. Like, he's an interesting cat. You know, he's not really – I don't think he's really the prick that he was made out to be. I think a lot of that was more image. And I think he's an interesting character, man. He like Sam Peckinpah, you know, he's got his foibles, he's got his flaws, like every interesting human being does. But I think that where Peckinpah had his
in the way that the Chinese say, man, live in interesting times.
Yeah, but beyond that, even, you know, like I think where Peckinpah had his, you know, he had his gun club. And he had his certain crew that he ran with, and if you weren't in that crew, then to hell with you. I think there was a humanitarian in Ford that was really trying to get out, you know? Like, I think there was a bright side.
I think a lot of his trouble sort of came from the fact that he felt so much affection for a lot of people.
Yeah, and he kind of...
When it turned, it became amplified.
Yeah, and he kind of had to insulate himself, you know? He kind of had to cut himself off, and I think... That's where a lot of the self-loathing and stuff came from. I think that's where a lot of his aberrant behavior came from, was the fact that he felt he had to cut himself off, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, like, the way he ran a film set, like how he tore down actors, you know? Like, if you came onto a set to do a job, you were fantastic. You were respected. You were – and that was that, you know? But if you came on
– Unless for Harry Carey Jr.
Yeah, but if you came onto the set as a celebrity, you know, if you came onto the set as a star – then he would be the first person to rip your bowels out and hand them to you.
His was the only ego on
set. Yeah, yeah, you know, like, there were no illusions about what went on a John Ford film set. You know, John Ford called shots, you know? And
you didn't fight the big war? Fuck you.
And just the way he shot as well, like everything was shot in camera. You know, he said himself, I think one of his big famous quotes was, you know, I tend to shoot very little film. I tend to give the committees very little to work with. Mm-hmm. You know,
early on, his experiences with the studios were he got burned a couple times, and after that, you know, he was so good at Hitchcock at seeing the movie in his head that he would shoot what he needed.
Yeah,
so
he would literally cut in camera.
Yeah,
you know, which is pretty impressive. It's that requires a hell of a lot of discipline, man.
Hmm.
And that's to be lauded, you know.
Absolutely. John, how about you? Any final thoughts?
Yeah, three words. The wide shot.
Hmm. Yeah, there we go.
I'm amazed none of us brought that up. You know, I kind of laid the hint earlier when I said John Ford invented Monument Valley.
Yeah. Mm. He wasn't a big fan of Monument Valley.
But John Ford did invent the wide shot.
Yeah, he wasn't a big fan of Close.
Okay, and any director out there, like, you know, I brought up during the Carpenter podcast about how he loves to kind of weirdly frame his wide shots.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Ford was an absolute master at it, and all of his movies were filmed. You know, you'll see people making fun of the older movies where you'll have, you know, like the Lawrence of Arabia shot where you've got this tiny little 3 or 4 pixel speck of an actor in the mm-hmm. distance of this wide panorama. That's all Ford.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and there's a great anecdote in the Bogdanovich documentary. Steven Spielberg talks about a time when he basically got the chance to meet John Ford for 1 minute in his office. John Ford sort of pointed at these two paintings. He said, all right, look at this one. Where's the horizon? And
yeah.
He, you know, he says, oh, it's at the bottom. And the next one, he says, okay, where's the horizon on that one? Oh, it's near the top. He says, when you know why the horizon should be at the top or the bottom and not in the middle, then you'll be a director.
Yeah. That was like Spielberg was only a teenager or something. He's like 12 or 13 years old, wasn't he? And he happened to show up and wanted to speak to John Ford at his office. And
he was like an intern or something.
Yeah. Yeah. He was just, you know, he was just happened to be there.
And something else.
John Ford dude said smashing a windshield glass over young Spielberg's face. Imparted upon him worldly wisdom.
And
he walked in dressed for a safari, though.
And something else about his use of the wide shot that I really took notice of was how he uses the use of deep focus, you know, to have the action mm-hmm. in the foreground and something else in the background. Like, I'm thinking especially of Drums Along the Mohawk, where there's this great shot where there's fighting going on, and in the background you still see the house burning.
That's the movie I wish I'd talked about, but yeah. That's a really good movie that hardly anyone knows about, I think, these days. Or at least hardly anyone talks about it.
Any more thoughts, John, before I go on?
No, but good.
All right.
Keep talking, John.
All right. Although I didn't have the time to watch many movies for this week's podcast, I must say I was very impressed with what I saw. And yeah, great visual director, great quiet moments. I like how he juggles all of the tones in his movies, the comedy, the pathos, the action. You know, it's all really blended in the really good ones. And I don't know, I think I will definitely watch more of his movies. This kind of got me hooked.
Searchers and The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. Cue them both up right now.
And
Donovan's Reef.
And
when
Steve talked about the other guys, I noticed that he forgot one important name, and that's where John Ford a bit. I know they're completely different, but I would put him, you know, up with Albert Hawks, you know.
Yes, yeah, definitely.
As that kind of innovator.
They were, you know, contemporaries, and I think they were friends, and obviously Wayne had a relationship with both of them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
There, you know, Hawks is much less of a sort of painterly visualist.
Yeah,
I think Hawks was more Hawks. Like, I mean, Hawks made good movies, you know, no doubt. but I don't think Hawks had the same impact on the medium that Ford had. You know, like, I don't think he had the same – he didn't define it the same way that Ford did. I think Hawks kind of
– innovations were more the dramatic, how you use the drum.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. Yeah, in opposite directions. Opposite directions.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. But we've talked about Hawks.
Yeah.
Well, don't go bringing up Baby.
No, it's because Young, as I said on Facebook, Young Mr. Lincoln kind of reminded me of something like Sergeant York, you know, just the tone of it.
And I'm pretty sure Red River Valley gets sung a lot in Ford movies.
And that's something, too, that I noticed. He seems to have something about putting kind of small, quote-unquote, musical numbers in his movies.
He basically, the Sons of the Pioneers are in a couple of his movies. And music of their sort, of these sort of small groups of men singing, especially folk tunes, he loved that stuff. That was
There's the Spanish lady or Mexican or whatever in Stagecoach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, he liked to have those sort of soft musical underpinnings to a lot of his quieter scenes, especially. I mean, if you think about it, like there's a scene in I think it's in Rio Grande where John Wayne is, you know, there's a Sons of the Pioneer song and he's sort of just It's after he's on duty and he's just standing there in Monument Valley in the dark by a river, kind of thinking about what he can do about the situation he's in, taking his hat in his hand. And it's one of those sort of great scenes that Ford can do where I think John Wayne basically said, you know, all you had to do was sort of stare.
Yeah.
And John Ford do all the rest, right?
Mm-hmm.
That was a cool moment. I know exactly the scene you're talking about, too. And that was, that was a cool moment, man.
Yeah. It's... I mean, as far as my own kind of final thoughts on Ford, I think he tended, I mean, in addition to sort of the very complicated and often sort of dark approach to the American West that he had, another one of his sort of constant themes was, I think, trying to portray the sort of family that he wished he had.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of his movies are, even when there are very distasteful and dark elements in them, there's a sense of idealism, both in terms of sort of on the personal level of the characters, but also sort of in his view of how sort of America became what it is, at sort of the best aspects of what built it. I think he liked to celebrate that a lot and celebrate kind of the sort of close-knit community that I think he saw was central to like the pioneer experience. You get that even in his non-Westerns, you have, excuse me, you know, like in Grapes of Wrath.
Yeah.
The relationship of the family sort of all knit together and going through this extremely trying set of circumstances. And, you know, How Green Was My Valley as well.
And even in movies like, I mean, I'm thinking of Stagecoach here where, like, there's no real family, but there's a family created in the trip.
There's a bond. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You've got all of these outcasts. You've got an outlaw and a prostitute and various other people who, for one reason or another, you know, civilized society has cast out.
Yeah.
And they come together. And I think that probably was very personal to him in terms of how he saw the world and where he sat in it.
And that's why I think, you know, like I think these little idyllic touches that he puts into his movies, I think that's a lot of why I think he is really, like, he was more of a humanitarian character than he made himself out to be.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there were definitely, I mean, he was a pendulum, you know, he went to both ends.
Yeah.
So anyway, he's awesome and you should all watch his movies. Except for the ones we talked about.
Except for Mogambo and Donovan's Reef.
And The Informer.
And The Informer.
All right, John, I think you're up next week. Who's your pick for next podcast?
Oh, do I have a treat for you, boys. And our listeners as well. Next week, we'll be delving into a spectrum of astonishing cinematic heights, bleak failure, and day-glow nipples.
Yes!
We rip deep into the works of director Joel Schumacher.
Ooh!
Nice to meet you.
And with that, we'll say see you next Wednesday.
Where are you, stop button?